All right, today we're going to talk a little bit about the Catholic Church's view on the priesthood, but we're going to start out with a little article from last month on Newsweek called, Is the Catholic Church Tarnished Beyond Repair? Subtitle, or I should say the caption below there, is Victims and Relatives of Children Who Claim They Were Targeted by the Catholic Church Sex Abusers Hold Placards as They Stand Outside the Venue for Australia's Royal Commission. So people who are, again, upset about the Catholic continual problem with Catholic priests sexually assaulting people in their care. Turn the page. When the chief executive of Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankfein, told the newspaper the company was doing God's work, his appeal on behalf of higher powers was an attempt to rescue the tainted reputation, not only his investment bank, but the entire industry. But for the Catholic Church, even this most obvious of strategies might not be enough to stem the inexorable decline. Okay, this is a short piece. The Church is one of the oldest and most profitable brands in history. Financial details are kept sketchy, but this vast multinational dwarfs any other. The Economist, which is a publication, has estimated that in 2010, spending by the U.S. branch of the Church and its various entities was $170 billion. Yet the Church is beset by problems. Let's see if I can put this in perspective for you. The Mormon Church cleared $6 or $7 billion 4 years ago. So after all expenditures, they had $7 billion in 1 year. The Catholic Church, by comparison, not their worldwide expenditures, but the U.S. only, spent in excess of 20 times that in the U.S. alone. As many brands have found out, handling the fallout from a disgrace is perhaps more important than the scandal itself. The dripfeed of negative headlines associated with sexual abuse and its cover-up has irreparably tarnished the Catholic brand for many. But to be fair, folks, I'm not sure it's ever possible to escape scrutiny from the media if you are known by anyone more than your family. Last night, while I was drifting off into Wonderland, I was reading a piece about the Sergeant Major from the movie We Were Soldiers. The dude's been dead like 5 years, since 2011. And he is having his records searched by the authorities at Fort Benning because he was a valor hog. He earned a Silver Star in Vietnam, but he took credit for having two or three, one from World War II, one from Vietnam, four combat jumps from World War II, Silver Star, two or three Bronze Stars from Korea. Anyway, if you know nothing about the Army, know that basically they're charging him now that he's been dead 5 years, with exaggerating his accomplishments. So if they're willing to, scrutinize a dead guy who is clearly a national hero, just not sure if he's a national hero to the extent that he claimed, then you are not without enemies in the media. They will do horrible things to you because that is the real court of public opinion, isn't it? So this whole you're innocent until proven guilty hardly applies anymore, anywhere. You know. So, there's a more fundamental threat to Catholicism, however, irrelevance. In other words, it doesn't matter. It is a testament to Pope Francis' skill that he has managed to reinvigorate the Church's standing despite continuing corruption and abuse controversies. Perhaps in a different life, his calling would have been working for a top advertising agency. The Church has refocused on its core brand strength of representing the vulnerable and regained moral momentum through its campaigns on peace, poverty, migration, environment, etc. For example, Pope Francis' decision to take three refugee families back to the Vatican following his visit to the Greek island of... There's got to be a better way to pronounce that. Here the Church has projected a clearer, stronger, and more urgent message that resonates with many. What? This stands in stark contrast to the socio-cultural values espoused by the Church. Socio-cultural, so things dealing with the behavior of the people in the Church. Socio-cultural values. These are now in opposition to majority moral attitudes in many parts of the world. When we get down to comforting distractions, you can. Such tensions may work in the short term for niche brands with a small group of loyal countercultural followers. Think about punk IPA beer on extremist violence fanatics, united by their love of beards but ignored by the mainstream. Standing for fringe values is obviously not viable for mass market appeal. So if you're against sexual trafficking, sex trafficking, you're probably not going to get noticed much. If, however, you want to talk about the evils of a particular religion, you're going to get the attention of the whole world, particularly if it's the oldest Christian religion. All right, go ahead.
Mobile phone company Nokia disappeared because it failed to keep up with the changing expectations of consumers over the size of its phone screen. What, therefore, are the consequences of diverging from public opinions and experiences of homosexuality, female equality, married life, sex, and parenthood?
All right, so let's talk for just a second. The Catholic Church is pretty old school on some things. We talked about their anti-abortion, pro-life idea. They are against homosexuality, although they are doing their best to make sure that people still feel welcomed in their organization. Female equality. Now, Newsweek is going to spin this. Anyone who's religious and doesn't think that women ought to be doing everything that the men are doing in the church, they're going to find a way to criminalize them or villainize them. Maybe that's a better word. So, in other words, you still are not going to have a woman deacon or a woman priest or a woman bishop or a woman archbishop in the Catholic Church. It's not happening. At least not yet. All right. Go ahead. Keep reading. A brand is two things.
A brand is two things. First, it is a solution to consumer needs. Humans look for the meaning in the chaotic universe, and religions compete. And religions compete with
distilleries,
retailers, social networks, movies, and many other things to provide, if not satisfying answers, then at least comforting distractions. The Catholic Church is no longer providing a solution that resonates for many, and fewer believe in such solutions when they are proposed by a discredited brand. Secondly, a brand is a community. When that community stands in opposition to the values and identifies
identities
of many of its members, it pushes them out. Their loss reduces diversity and damages the creativity and vibrancy that keep a brand alive and attractive. Those who remain are more exclusive and out of step with outsiders. As people are pushed out or left to feel unwelcome, they look elsewhere. Gay clergy members are forced to mask their identity if they are to remain. The LGBT Catholic community monitors gay-friendly Catholic parishes. Many have split from the mainstream church in the threat of
a schism
of homosexuality continually looms. Non-belief relentlessly expands its market share. Young people in America are significantly less religious than other older generations.
All right, stop there. I disagree. If we can define religion as a system of trust and reliance, everyone is just as religious as they have always been. They just may not always worship a being outside of themselves or outside of their community. They might be humanists, they might be atheists, they might be agnostics, but they are all of them are religious. I do not mean that they worship God like I do or like you do. I mean that they have a system of reliance and dependence and constance. That is to say that they are always doing something in keeping with a value system, even if they say they don't have a value system. It's bunk. Everyone has limits as to what they will do. Those limits might be externally imposed through a lack of resources, but they do have limits. All right, read.
Non-belief relentlessly expands its market share. Young people in
America... Sounds familiar. Next paragraph.
Meanwhile, niche operators are moving in...
That's the brand of Percy Carey. Niche. Go ahead, continue. Syncretic
religions that fuse Christianity with traditional or New Age beliefs are expanding rapidly in Latin America.
All right, stop. Now, why we are reading this is partially so that we can be educated as to the subject matter, but it's also partially so that you can be trained through the example I'm trying to set here, that when you read with a filter. You don't just But it'd be really neat if I could get some of you just to read something that's not fiction, okay? Or something in, you know, the Divergent series or something like that. If I get you to read something that's not a sports piece or a Facebook status update, that would be a miracle. But to get you to read something that you are actually thinking through what you're reading and wondering, is this author an idiot? Or do they at least have a bias? Okay, because here he's talking about syncretic religions, particularly popular in Latin America. What is Latin America? Is that like a neighborhood in the Bronx where they speak Latin?
Central America.
Central-ish America, Catholic America, Spanish America. Okay, so some of those, it's like a Venn diagram. Parts of all of those are not in Latin America. But Latin America is almost entirely sub-United States, Spanish-speaking Catholic. Okay, and what do we have in Mexico but a morphing of the strange idea of Islam and Catholicism? In the Caribbean, you have the strange morphing of Catholicism and voodoo. And it comes out as a sort of Santeria, S-A-N-T-A-R-I-A, Santeria, in Boston, New York, other places. So these syncretic religions where you can have kind of the old way with the new way, all of a sudden we realize that Catholicism is just doing what's always done. In Southern Europe in the 200s and 300s, it took the religion and the ideas of the barbarians and the pagans and took them as their own. The festivals of the gods became festivals of the saints. Temples to pagan gods became temples to the Lord Jesus Christ and the imperial church, and became called, and they become churches. So this idea of syncretic religion is incredibly popular, and it's so popular that when you graduate from Berean Baptist Academy, you're going to meet people that will say they're just as Christian as you are. However, they are inclusive at best and pluralistic at worst. And remember that three-column chart I gave you earlier in the year, where there are people that will say, yes, I believe I'm saved because I believed on Christ, but I'm not sure that's the only way. The Buddhist, if he's sincere, he may end up going. And what you've done is you've decided that a non-personal God-believing religion is just as good as a monotheistic religion. And you have actually crossed worldviews that are just crazy different. Crazy. But you're syncretic. You're a culturally syncretic person. You take something that is clearly wrong, and you move into it with your lattes and your freshman college classes, and you want to fit, and so you say nothing that disagrees with popular culture, and you become basically a passive syncretic. Keep reading.
Non-Catholic Christian denominations.
Catholic. I love it. Let's try it again.
Non-Catholic Christian denominations are building megachurches throughout Africa. These flexible competitors have aligned themselves closely with local customs, interests, and landscapes to offer a more relevant and inclusive brand.
Great, and that is why you have the prosperity gospel in Nigeria just picking up all kinds of steam. It is witch doctor religion mixed with Christianity. Make the gods do what you want by doing things for them. You exchange killing a chicken and messing around with powder and water in the back of a hut, and you replace it with giving more money, and God blesses you. It's just it's the same religion. They've just swapped names of their gods. It's the same God. They're trying to get the God in the heaven to drop down rain. So instead of a rain dance, they show up to church and give their offering, and then more offering. Syncretism. It's alive and well in Africa. Keep up, sweaters. Go ahead.
The problems faced by the Catholic Church are not unique. Religious friends of all stripes are facing similar existential crises. From Mecca to Rome to India's Varanasi, social cultural changes are outpacing the ability of traditional religious friends to keep up, and they are failing to provide brand solutions and communities that appeal.
Yes, Jasmine, you may read. Go ahead.
Trapped in the squeezed mid-market, they are caught between liberalization to the point of Episcopalian ephemera, whereby doctrine becomes so openly interpreted that a religion is no longer centrally organized or structurally cohesive. Alternatively, they survive by fueling the fires of a shrinking and otherwise off-putting conservative minority.
Well, let's talk about that a minute. So if you stay in the conservative minority, this Newsweek writer is saying you're shrinking. I'm sorry, that's not true. Maybe it's true for Catholicism, but it's actually not shrinking. You can go to growing Christian conservative churches all over America. Are they relevant? Now, that's a different discussion, but they're not shrinking. There are churches that are shrinking. So if he's talking about conservative Catholicism, I don't have a good grasp of that. Maybe you do. I don't know. But it is not a good representation of conservative Catholicism, and I know it's not a good representative of conservative Christianity. Oh, you're good.
The marketing response has repeatedly been one of rage, from political Hindus suppressing dissent to the murder of blasphemous bloggers by Islamists. The evidence is that religious brands cannot and will not accept change. This only serves to underline the disconnection between religious brands and social reality. Research suggests that anti-gay, anti-science attitudes are turning people away from religion in the U.S. For example, in a globalized and hyper-connected world, scandals, hypocrisy, lies, financial cover-ups, and generally
obfuscated
moral messages are shared, picked apart, and rejected faster than ever.
Sure, but I mean, look what our messages have become. They're memes. They're stupid. They're t-shirts and bumper stickers and billboards. Let's talk God. Remember that? Have you seen that billboard on I-95? Have you read the book I wrote? It's the best-selling. I mean, that's so lame. That's the kind of stuff that they're picking apart. Christians aren't perfect, just forgiven. Lame! Stop reducing everything you believe to a silly t-shirt slogan. Stop it. Because it cheapens the message, and they are picking it apart. And that's the kind of stuff that we think we're being persecuted because we reduce our views to, to true love waits. Okay, I know, but what in the world do you mean by that? And how does that help people become... I tell you, I read a stat today by Elton John, okay? Yeah, this guy, he's a flamer, right? He's married to a man, has two children. He said, now listen to this. This is how you can twist statistics. He cites that if you are a female transgender, you are 49% more likely to carry HIV. 49? No, that isn't even correct. That's not what he said. 49 times more likely. 49% would be great. That's only 1.5 times more likely. 49 times more likely to be HIV infected if you're a transgendered female versus what? Versus being a regular female. And here's what he said. All right, now think about how this is twisted on its head. You've got to see this. I would say it's because of their wicked lifestyle and having many sexual partners. He said, it's because, well, of course they're more likely. They are, get this now. They are disenfranchised in society. They are discriminated against constantly. And so they are pushed into sex work. Now think about that. Elton John is blaming the HIV-infested world of female transgenderism on everyone else. Because female transgender people are not accepted, and so they have to go into work that involves sex. That's what Elton John says. So we look at it, we're like 49 times more likely to die of a sexually transmitted disease if you're a transgender female. But it's because of everyone else. It's not because of the 0.03% of the population doing that stuff. It's because of the 99.7% that are actually not for it. And they're pushing those people into other... Well, come on. So you can take statistics and flip it towards your presupposition. And that's the problem. That really is a problem. Now, is the statement here that says anti-gay, anti-science attitudes are turning people away from religion? Maybe so. But we haven't identified what kind of religion. Because the Pope, since 1979, has said that Genesis 1 through 11 is myth. Pope John Paul II said it's myth. Now, think that through. Since 1979, the Catholic Catechism has stated, or at least the Pope John Paul II, I can find the quote for you, has stated that Genesis 1 through 11 is myth. It may be true, it may not be. He does not believe in biblical creationism, at least not the Pope three popes ago. So they already are not anti-science. So what's this Newsweek guy talking about? I will not know. I do not know.
This guy's punctuation is terrible.
Last paragraph. Or second to last, instead.
Instead, a reflective marketing approach is required. One that recognizes that individuals and societies are changing and that brands need to change as well if they are to survive. The Catholic Church needs to research, respect, and respond to changing consumer needs and values. If it does not, it will continue to decline.
All right, I need you to see that, and I need you to look. I had you turn to 1 Timothy 4. We're going to look at it in a minute, but look at chapter 3. Look at verse 15. Here's what Paul says to Timothy. If I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar and buttress of truth. The King James is pillar and ground of truth. Great indeed, we confess, is the mystery of godliness. He was manifest in the flesh, vindicated by the Spirit, seen by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on the world, taken up in glory. Hey, pay attention. Apparently, the mission of the church, according to Paul, is not being a needs meter. Now, look at the second to last paragraph of this page. The Catholic Church needs to research, respect, and respond to changing consumer needs and values. Well, in defense of the Catholic Church and all other religions that are supposedly, by this author, shrinking and turning people away, the mission of the church is not to be appealing. You'll never find that in the Bible. The mission of the church is to be a pillar and ground for truth. Love one another? Sure. But in relation to the world, the mission of the church is to be very clear about what is true. Not what meets your little needs and values. So this Newsweek writer is coming at this as a marketer. But the reason the Catholic Church may not make this is because the Catholic Church needs to change to the consumer's needs and values. How stupid are you? That's not their point. Hopefully that's not the Catholic Church's point. In other news, look at chapter 4, verse 1. Now, in the latter times, the Spirit expressly says, the King James is really wordy. The King James is really good for lisps, people with lisps. It says, the Spirit speaketh expressly. In the King James, fantastic. But here, now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons. What else did they do? Verse 2. To the insincerity of liars whose consciences are sacred. What else did they do? See, thank you. Yeah, their consciences are not sacred. Thank you. Verse 3. That's what you get for sight reading every now and then. Verse 3. What else do? They forbid marriage. And require abstinence from foods that God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. So, apparently, there are going to be people that will give heed to demonic teaching. And some of these demonic teachings are listed as such. And they come from a seared conscience, from a liar. What are some of these things? Paul, what would be the first thing you would list? Number one, they forbid people from marrying. What else do they do? They are so weird about telling you you should not eat certain food. Now, I don't know if you're going to keep reading. I hope you read this chapter at least once in your life. But think this through. You've got to see this. This is almost so silly that it's only obvious if you'll read it with your own eyeballs. He lists two seemingly silly things as demonic doctrines that will rear their head. One has to do with what you eat, and the other has to do with not marrying. So, without further adukes, we're going to talk today about celibate priesthood in the Catholic Church. For just a few minutes. The celibate priesthood. Celibate. That does not mean that they're happy about it and they have banners. That is celebrate. This is celibate. There's nothing to be happy about with this. Okay, maybe that's not true. But in any case, I suppose everyone should be celibate at some stages of their life, like pre-marriage. But we're talking about the priests. We're not talking about just the priests remaining pure sexually before they're married. We're talking about them not marrying at all. The Oxford Dictionary of the Bible speaks of the Western Church, particularly the Roman Catholic Church, a legal position was gradually reached by which all the higher clergy must be celibate. And it talks about early on with some of the early church fathers. 386, a decretal of Pope Siricius ordered celibacy for priests and Levites. This is repeated by Pope Innocent I of the 400s. Throughout the Middle Ages, there were repeated efforts to enforce celibacy on those in holy orders. Holy orders has to do with being either a priest or a deacon. And the Second Lateran Council of 1139 made the marriage of clerics not only unlawful but invalid. So if you were married, no, you're not anymore. All right. By 1983, the 1983 Codex Lurius Canonici states that clerics are bound to celibacy and that a man who has a wife is impeded from receiving orders unless he is destined for the permanent diaconate. What does that mean? Unless you want to be a permanent deacon. Okay, now we're not going to talk about that too much. I want you to see that it is church law that priests not marry. Not allowed to be married. Now let's talk about this little deacon group, diaconate, the group of deacons. Why are we calling it a diaconate? It's an old word. The Greek word behind deacon is diakonos, and that's why it's called a diaconate. Dia, by the way, means through. So the word deacon means, or diakonos means through the dirt. So it's the idea of being a servant. The origin of the diaconate is traced to Acts 6, 1 Timothy 3. The earliest functions were practical concern for the poor, preaching, baptizing, distribution of the Holy Eucharist, or communion. Diaconate in the Roman Catholic Church tradition, has been a step toward priesthood and in recent centuries reserved to celibate candidates for that order. In recent years, diaconate is now open to married men interested in liturgical, pastoral, administrative work in the church. Again, though, it needs to be, restated. If you wish to be a priest in the Catholic Church, you must remain celibate. From the Dictionary of Christianity in America. On another front, the Catholic Church has recently been seeing controversy over the requirement that priests be celibate. And by the way, what do you think the connection? I think there's a connection between telling a man that he can never have intimate relations with anyone and a guild of a profession that is so marked by sexual deviance. Tell a man who's supposed to be a sexual being, tell him you're not allowed to do that, ever. Well, that's proving to be a little too much for some of them. In the Eastern Orthodox tradition, married priests have always been allowed, and in the early centuries of the Roman Church, priests were permitted to marry. But the Roman priesthood was gradually limited to celibates. Since the 1960s, an unprecedented number of men have left the priesthood. Hey, look at 1 Corinthians 7. Let's talk about those who are gifted to celibacy. Gifted to celibacy. And I'm going to present two extremes. I know I am. And I'm sure there's lots of questions for in between. 1 Corinthians 7. And you're going to see here why. Why celibacy is way, the lifestyle celibacy is really not supposed to be something everyone tries. All right, look at verse 1. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, but because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer. But then coming together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So as a concession, not a command, I say this, I wish for all as myself, but each of his own gift from God, one of one kind, one of another. To the unmarried and the widow, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am, but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. It's better to marry than to burn with passion. Paul gives an argument here for getting married, and what is it? It's get married so you're no longer tempted to fornicate. It's kind of a harsh verb. Anyway, to the married, I'll be right there. Verse 10, I give this charge. Not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband. All right. Verse 17. Let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which the Lord has called him. So he just got done saying, I think it's better for everyone if they stay single. Only if they can. And he said, it's my opinion. He said that. He said that in parentheses back there in those verses. Verse 20. Each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you a bondservant when you were when called? Do not be concerned about it. 22. For he who was called in the Lord is a bondservant. Verse 23. You were bought with a price. Do not become bondservants of men. 25. Concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as won by the Lord's mercy. Verse 27. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. He says, it is going to be tough on you Christians to be married. 29. This is what I mean, brothers. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none. Now, that is not what it looks like on face value. Be careful. And those who mourn as though they were not mourning. And those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing. In other words, being persecuted as a Christian would mean lots of separation time between husbands and wives. Prison. Exile. All right. Verse 32. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about the worldly things, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. So, it's very clear here. If you're married, your first ministry is your spouse. If you're not married, you have the liberty not to be a selfish idiot. You have liberty to do more for the Lord. But remember, earlier in the chapter, he said, you need to get married instead of burning in your passion. Verse 36, if anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly towards his betrothed, in other words, you have this girlfriend and you are very close, if his passions are strong and it has to be, let him do as he wishes. Let them marry. It is no sin. So he introduces the idea here. It's a pretty good chapter. The King James English is really hard, but this is actually pretty easy to read. He gives the understanding here that only certain people can stay celibate, and they are gifted to that. They're called to that. It's a special enablement. Most people are not. So the idea that you can have hundreds of thousands of priests who are all gifted to celibacy is highly unlikely. For one thing, we only think that Christians are gifted from the Spirit. That's the first thing. But for another thing, what about all the priests that are, even if they were saved, what are the likelihood that they're all gifted to celibacy? And yet the church requires it from them. That means that most of them are burning in their lust and should be getting married. Here's from the Youth Catechism. Why does the church require priests and bishops to live a celibate life? Jesus lived as a celibate, and in this way intended to show his undivided love for God the Father. Yeah, it's much better. I fixed it. I knew what I did wrong yesterday. And all the pictures that you saw yesterday, which are deplorable, are fantastic.
Thanks.
You just don't take my word for it.
Sure.
So their argument is, hey, Jesus was celibate. So I can't be Christ-like if I'm married somehow. Yes?
I like to look at the Peter argument that you brought up, that he had a wife.
Yes. Interesting. Is that what you were going to say earlier? Yeah, Peter had a wife. Yeah. You know, this argument here, if Jesus wasn't a celibate, what would they do about Mary's perpetual virginity? Because we talked about four similarities, and they love Mary. There's something about this church. They want a woman figure in heaven that they can pray to. Remember, Jesus is sinless, Mary was sinless. Jesus was born without sin, Mary was born without sin. Jesus was celibate, Mary was celibate. Jesus went to heaven without after he died, Mary went to heaven without dying. And there's all these parallels. Virgin conceived. So what happens if we have Jesus having a wife? Well, you have Mormons who believe Jesus had several wives, right? And other religions as well. But if you believe that Jesus was married, then it really messes this up a lot. And then what's your main argument? so anyway. You've seen the biblical perspective of marriage, why Paul says you should get married. You've seen his perspective in 1 Timothy 4 that it is a demonic doctrine to say that you should not be getting married, forbidding people to get married. What's that?
Just that Warren, the FLDS prophet that did that.
Warren Jeffs?
Jeffs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great end times illustration. Any comments about this topic? Tomorrow, we'll talk about sainthood. Three types of saints in the Roman Catholic Church.
Can I bring in my football team?
Yeah, I would like that.